Hi, my name's Emma Bartlett, and I am a partner here at CM Murray. And this morning I'm talking to Maisie Lockyer, who is an associate at Burgess Mee, prestigious family law firm. And we're going to be talking this morning, given that it's Neurodiversity Celebration Week 2024, we're talking about neurodiversity and how that impacts what we do in our jobs, but particularly Maisie, as she has a particular interest and expertise in this area. Hi, Maisie, how are you?
Hiya, I'm good, thank you.
Thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Before we get started, it'd be really useful if you could just explain what your day-to-day job is. What sort of things do you get up to?
Of course, so I'm a family solicitor, which often is incredibly varied. There's a lot of divorce, a lot of financial proceedings that flow from divorce, also disagreements about children and child arrangements. And things like prenups and postnuptial agreements. So, really covers all areas of family law, quite honestly.
Sounds very varied and interesting. But what caused you to become interested in neurodiversity and how that impacts your job?
It's I guess, a long story of sorts. I mean, I've always been interested in neurodiversity. I've got a few family members who have a neurodivergence. I've got a cousin who's autistic. And in primary school, I had a lot of people in my class who had additional needs and neurodivergencies. So I've had this interest from a young age. And then what really piqued my interest, I think, within family law, I've had cases previously where we have benefited from an intermediary within family proceedings. And that was specifically for somebody with learning difficulties. And at the time, I thought, my goodness, this would be so helpful for somebody who had, for example, autism. Would it be helpful if I explain what an intermediary is?
Yes, please, because we don't. So I'm an employment lawyer and we don't have intermediaries in the employment courts
Sure.
at all. So I'm interested to hear that what they are, what they do.
Great. So an intermediary is someone who's appointed within proceedings to, first of all, assess a party or a witness to see whether or not they have any additional needs that can be dealt with so that they can properly engage in proceedings. But then, secondly, they're supported through proceedings. So they will come to hearings, they will address the judge and say, these are the specific needs that this person might have. This is the way they might present, for example. So just really supporting them. And I think that's why. Again, I come back to autism, but that's why I suddenly thought, gosh, this would be really useful to talk about more. Because I think when someone has a visible disability or a learning disability, people are very aware of how to help them. But for lesser known divergencies, let's say neurodivergencies, sometimes people will present in a way that is unusual or can appear hostile, especially in a very stressful situation like court proceedings. And that could, if giving evidence, go against them. And so anything that we can do that means that they're able to give their best evidence, we should be doing it. So really, that's why I got into it. Long story.
No, but a very relevant story. I mean, in the employment tribunal system, the court will ask whether anybody needs assistance as a if they are disabled, and the court will make adjustments as appropriate. But where somebody has a neurodivergent condition, they may not necessarily be aware that they have that condition and therefore need assistance, or they may not want to disclose it in the proceedings. Which is absolutely their prerogative. So, their ability to request adjustments on the basis of a one line on the Employment Tribunal form can be overlooked. And I was interested in what you were saying there about the way people give evidence, because it's so important in the type of tribunals that we deal with that people will look at how somebody's given evidence, because at the end of the day, in an employment tribunal situation, they may be trying to understand who's telling the truth? And they could be looking at body language, how somebody presents themselves, how somebody answers a question. And that's in a neurodivergent situation, that person's vulnerability may manifest itself in a different way, which could impact their ability. Is that how you've, can you give any examples of
Yeah,
that
of course.
vulnerabilities.
So, for example, someone with ADHD might overload you with information. They might not answer a question directly. They may go round and round the subject and may not stop until they've said what they want to say. And that might come across as evasive, for example, which is unhelpful. Someone with autism may not be able to fully appreciate certain nuances in questions. They may give very direct answers. Sometimes that can come across as rude. And that again is unhelpful if we're talking about how someone presents and what that means for whether or not they're telling the truth. Those just small differences in the way that they present is it's difficult. And then I guess coming back to something like dyslexia, it's not so much how they might present, but in a very stressful situation, they will be taken to a written statement and asked to read sections of it. And they will find that incredibly stressful and incredibly difficult. And I imagine it will completely exacerbate their dyslexia. And they may panic. They may not be able to say, oh, I said this, or I understand what was written here. And again, that really impacts on their best evidence.
Yeah, I can see where you have a witness who might be stumbling over what appears to be their words in their statement, that could count against them, and the barrister or representative on the other side could actually challenge whether that is their evidence. You know, you're stumbling
Exactly.
over your own words, and that's.
You can see how there's room for somebody to take advantage of it. Whereas if you've got someone there who says, no, hang on a second, this is their neurodivergency, you can't discriminate against them for the way they're presenting, then immediately that takes some pressure off that situation.
Yeah, that's so important. I was interested in, I saw that you've obviously written several articles on this, and one of the points that you talked about was the fact that diagnostic guidance on a lot of neurodivergent conditions is largely created for men, or based on male individuals. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
It's, I mean, when I was growing up, I remember that there was this just general rule that only boys really had autism. And also, boys had ADHD. And I think when you think of stereotypes of both diversities, you think of the male stereotype. And the reason it went so long before women started to be diagnosed is because girls and women are taught to mask. Taught to behave, taught how to fit into social constructs from such a young age, they do it naturally in a way that means that they don't then fit into this really very stereotypical box for what is autism or what is ADHD. And girls and women will find that they present so differently because they've tried so hard for so long just to fit in. So for example, for autism, there used to be this view that people who are autistic weren't very good at demonstrating empathy. They weren't very good in social situations. That is not strictly the case with girls and women because they're so desperate to fit in at a young age. They mask, they do all these things. So, for example, they'll mirror, they'll see how other kids who are neurotypical are behaving and they will copy them. So, for everybody else looking in, they look neurotypical, even if on the inside they're struggling massively and just copying what they see. And to a degree, I think it's very similar with ADHD as well. I think the way that it manifests is not hyperactive. Sometimes that's the case, but when you think of young boys, they're hyperactive, they're not listening. Whereas with girls, it's more anxiety. Difficulty controlling emotions, also different ways of thinking, but disorganization. And a lot of that will come out in later life. But they manage to control it or hide it really when they're little, sadly.
I'm really interested in hearing you speak about how, as a lawyer, we can assist a neurodiverse client right from the point that they first contact you through to the end process when we're there in front of the judge. How do you, what different things might you do for a neurodiverse client?
Well, I think from the outset, it's really important as a matter of practice to ask anybody who comes through the door or through the inbox, are there any reasonable adjustments that you require? I think people who have a neurodivergency, there's no one size fits all. Everybody is completely different. And so what one person might ask for in terms of reasonable adjustments is not going to be the same as the next person. And so we must always be guided by the client or the party or whoever it is. So I think that's the first step. But I think being aware of things that might assist is also helpful. So, for example, setting out very early on what kinds of communication styles that you can adopt if that assists. So, for example, if someone is dyslexic, you can say, I'm going to send you written advice, but also I will read it to you on the phone if that helps. We can discuss it on the phone. I think it's still helpful to have that document that they can rely on. But still, that's how I would go about it. Somebody with ADHD may really struggle to process detailed information verbally. So for them, I would back everything up with written advice and written communication so that they have it to go back over. And sometimes that's also true of people with autism. They will struggle in stressful situations to process. Whether or not they shut down, maybe it's that, maybe it's just a coping mechanism, or just, I don't know, honestly, stress. But the way that I would deal with it is to offer always to say, we'll speak about it and I'll back up with written communication so that they've got a record. And I think that's always going to be very helpful, especially with advice. Well, I guess that's communication. I think sometimes. I've had a client before with autism, and we had to have, aside from just our normal client care letter, we had a document that set out ground rules because he was very good at following rules and sticking to boundaries. But if you didn't spell it out, he didn't see it as a rule. So, for example, he would like to be contacted immediately, regardless of the day of the week or the time or the hour. So we had to say, look, these are the times we'll respond. We're not going to respond in other times. And also to set the boundaries of our professional relationship as well. We're not therapists, we're lawyers, so we're here for legal advice, but we're not here to provide you with that additional therapeutic advice because that's not our job or specialism. Things like that. It was really helpful to have it set down in writing so that we didn't drift later, because that ultimately impacts on the client relationship, which is not good. And then in terms of like meetings, discussing things like timeouts or rest breaks, that's helpful for everybody. Inviting people to have a friend present if that's helpful, who's not involved in proceedings, somebody who can help and be there to support and also digest information, that can be helpful. Those are just some things that are outside of court. When you get to court, it's already a very stressful environment. So I think what I found helpful is to provide a really detailed breakdown of the day and what's expected and what people are going to do at various times. I've also provided clear instructions and made a note of what else is available in the area if you need a break, for example. We're quite lucky in family law because we can do things within the court system and we can do things outside of the court system in a less formal setting. And in those situations, you can also ensure that there's breakout rooms so someone can go off and have a time out if it's necessary. But things like really simple things like, so if somebody enjoys music and that's the way that they ground themselves if they're feeling overwhelmed, making sure that they know to bring their headphones so that they can, if necessary, take a moment, calm down, center themselves. Really small things. Often things like clothing can agitate someone, and professional clothing especially. So if you're going to court, people might think, oh gosh, I've got to wear a suit or tie or something like that. And that might then make them feel incredibly uncomfortable. And saying to them that isn't necessary, or having the conversation in advance where you say, these are the rules, these are the things that we don't need to stress about, these are things that we slightly need to stress about, I think can be helpful so that you just alleviate some of that unknown or as much as possible. Sorry, that was a lot.
It was a lot, but it was all really useful and relevant. And while some of those things might seem like really small things, as you say, it can make the difference between somebody not participating in proceedings and being able to, or somebody being able to come across and deliver what they need to say in a way that can be understood or not, as the case may be. I have one last question, which is just picking up on something you said there about we're not therapists, we're also not medical experts. So if somebody doesn't tell us that they have a neurodiversity, then how, and we've given them the opportunity to tell us, but it may be obvious to us that there may be a neurodiversity there. How do you approach that? Is it a case of having the right words to ask the question? Because it could not be well received. It might be something that's well received or not, but we don't know. How would you approach that where you suspect that the client may have a neurodiversity?
I think it's very tricky. I don't think that it's our place necessarily to come out and say, I think you might have ADHD or autism, what do you think? I think that would be quite harmful perhaps to the client solicitor relationship. So I think I'd steer clear of that. But I think what I would do is, if I had a suspicion, I would go through the steps that I would usually do with someone who had a confirmed diagnosis and who'd communicated that, and treat them as though that were the case. So I would ask about reasonable adjustments. I would identify any traits that I saw and ask them if there was anything that I could do to help with that. So, for example, if it was someone who answered questions at length and in the roundabout answering your question, I would highlight that and say, look, I can see that you're doing this. How can I get a direct answer from you? How can I assist? And I think often in family cases that go to court, we recommend that parties speak to a witness preparation or familiarization company so that they're familiar with the court, certainly, and what it's like to give evidence. And if there was someone who I thought they're going to struggle with this for X, Y, and Z, I would heavily recommend that they underwent that sort of training, because they would then be the ones who would say, you're doing this, this isn't going to be helpful, this is what a judge is going to think. So I would, as I say, I'd treat it as though it was a formal diagnosis, but without being the one to potentially change their life by saying, by the way, I think that you've got this.
I think that's an incredibly helpful approach and the right approach as well. I mean, there is no correct answer to any of this, but given that under the Equality Act, an employer, for example, is deemed with that they have to make reasonable adjustments for an employee if they know that they have a disability, and not all neurodiversities are disabilities, but if it is something which puts them at a particular disadvantage in the workplace. Or from what they know about the individual, they can be deemed with constructive knowledge of a disability. Then they have to make the reasonable adjustments anyway. So you don't need, and it's the same. You know, we are service providers under the Equality Act, and if we consider that somebody has a particular disability, we don't need them to formally tell us before we make the adjustment. So I really like the way that you've just put it there, where you could say, I can say, for example, if you have a client who's got thought disorder, as you say, when they're bouncing between topics and unable to get to the answer without going around the houses, then addressing the manifestation of something and saying, how best can we get you to be able to deal with this is a really good way. Maisie, I've really enjoyed talking to you, and I think other people will find this incredibly valuable and insightful. So thank you very much for taking the time to do this.
Thank you for having me.